popular politics. What does the term popular politics and radicalism mean in the 18th century? The term radicalism is anachronistic and doesn't have a clear reference in an 18th century context. Historians cannot present it as a coherent and enduring movement. Support is episodic, activists are often divided, and politicians are opportunistic. There are some continuities, but these are often loose and broad connections. The 19th century definition says that someone who holds the most advanced views of political reform along democratic lines is a radical, but this does not really apply in the 18th century. In fact, many of those arguing for electoral reform in the early 18th century want to restrict the franchise to create a purer, less corrupt electorate. Popular participation in politics had somewhat stultified during the reigns of the first two Georges, but this traditional view is increasingly under challenge by those who recognise a lively out-of-doors political culture. Historians such as Linda Colley, Gary de Craye, Paul Langford, Nick Rogers and W.A. Speck recognise a vibrant political culture in this so-called age of Whig oligarchy. Kathleen Wilson has included an imperial dimension to this. The 18th century English radical tradition focused on a vigorous resistance to ruling cartels, a sense of liberty and freedom amongst the English. This freedom incorporated freedom before the law, including the right to trial by jury. Things like habeas corpus, religious toleration, and property rights. Any attempts to extend standing armies, erect military barracks, centralise the police forces, or introduce tax collection met with fierce resistance. Thus, radicalism in this period was less about progress and the creation of new rights, and more about the defence of rights that it was perceived had always been held by the English people and were enshrined in documents such as the Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights. This lecture is going to look at these various elements through the lenses of three movements: the Jacobites, those opposed to the excise crisis, and the Wilkites. But first, I just want to briefly look at the role of the Whigs and Tories. The fate of political parties in this period is that Whigs and Tories no longer existed as separate entities in politics. It's been argued that they were not focused on particular problems, and therefore did not supply clear lines of divisions in politics. The Tory party in particular had ceased to exist and had become a mere mentality. They had no organisation on a national scale and no acknowledged leader in Parliament. John Brooke has written that the Tories were preeminently the landed gentry, unconnected with the court, a social group rather than the political party. But revisionist historians such as Holmes, Speck and Colley have insisted the Tories did adapt effectively to a changing political and social scene. They invented a new Tory populism, which became a reaffirmation of libertarian principles. Thus, the period before 1760s sees a metamorphosis of the Whigs from the party of the people to the party of established wealth and oligarchy, and the Tories from the party of established wealth to the party of the people. J.C.D. Clarke has argued that Toryism was kept alive by adhering to Stuart loyalism via Jacobitism. So, who were the Jacobites and how popular were they? Jacobitism, although with hindsight unsuccessful, did prove one of the most enduring forms of opposition to the established regime in Britain from 1688 until the 1750s. It had a parliamentary base and much support in the country. The term Jacobite was the name for those who supported James after his deposition. The first rebellion occurred in Scotland in 1689, after the Scottish Convention had accepted William III as king. Viscount Dundee, known as Bonnie Dundee, withdrew from the convention in protest and raised a small army. He had a spectacular victory, but it was won at the cost of his own life, and without a leader, the rebellion was fought to a standstill. When James died in 1701, his son, known as the Old Pretender, became the legitimate King of Scotland in the eyes of the Jacobites. In 1707, the union took place between Scotland and England. Given the unpopularity of the union in Scotland, it allowed the Jacobites to portray themselves as nationalists, whatever the reality. But in practice, although the union was unpopular, most Scots were unwilling to resist it by force. In 1708, the Old Pretender set out from France, his expedition sponsored by Louis XIV, but in the event the expedition was a fiasco and James did not even land in Scotland. The next military attempt to regain the British throne was in 1715, perhaps the best chance the Jacobites had of restoring the exiled Stuart dynasty. The 1715 rebellion was an attempt originated by the Earl of Mar to capitalise both with discontent at the Union and the accession of George I to the English throne. The Jacobite standard was raised on 6th of September 1715 in the North East Highlands. There was widespread support for the rebellion, and Jacobite forces initially outnumbered the British government forces. But early victories were not capitalised upon, and the Jacobites eventually surrendered to government forces at Preston on the 14th of November 1715. In the years following, the exiled Jacobite court engaged in plotting and planning, but the court was comprehensively infiltrated by British spies. Scare stories of possible Jacobite invasions were not so much real as Whig propaganda to divert attention from their own regime. However, a French invasion of Britain was planned to restore the Stuarts in early 1744, and a serious force was assembled, 10,000 French troops of the regular army, and the young pretender, Bonnie Prince Charlie, was secretly summoned to France to embark with the invasion fleet. The French would probably have achieved their objectives if they could have got across the Channel, but weather delayed the invasion plans and the initiative was lost. In the event, the rebellion took place in 1745, led by Bonnie Prince Charlie. On the 19th of August, the Jacobite standard was raised in Scotland and Charles marched to Edinburgh, virtually unopposed. He also managed to muster a force for the invasion of England, getting all the way to Derby without any resistance. The prince was keen to continue the march to London, but the British military held firm and he retreated to Scotland. The end came for the Jacobite cause on 16th of April 1746. At Drummossie Moor near Inverness. Charles fled the field before the battle was over and escaped to France. Historians are divided about the contribution Jacobitism made to opposition politics. There are those descended from the Romantic tradition of Jacobitism, which was largely created by Walter Scott in the 19th century, and look back on the Jacobites sentimentally. Sir Charles Petrie, for example, argued Jacobitism was a genuine political movement. Evelyn Cruikshanks has argued that the Tory party were deeply involved with Jacobitism. And Paul Monnow has done a study of the social history of Jacobitism, suggesting that it infiltrated all levels of society. Other historians, though, have portrayed the Jacobites as out of touch and unpopular. They've argued that the power of the British state ultimately kept the Jacobites at bay and defeated them. But many historians ignore Jacobitism or dismiss it briefly. Turning now to the excise crisis of 1733. This was a purely domestic affair. Walpole had been concerned to reduce the burden of the land tax and shift government revenues to other sources. The excise scheme promised revenues which would permit a permanent reduction of the land tax. He'd already introduced excise duties on tea, chocolate, coffee and salt, and thought that his new excise bill would pass without any difficulties in the Commons, as he had a huge majority. But as it turned out, the opposition marshalled an intense and effective campaign against the measure. Tory gentlemen retained a conviction that it was their duty to shield their inferiors. The price of this paternalism was the land tax. Others were opposed to all aspects of Walpole's policies, and so were inclined to ignore their interests as taxpayers. Excise duties involved giving extensive powers of search to revenue officers, and that thus this was resisted by people who argued that Englishmen had rights to privacy in their own property and also to trial by jury. There was an orchestrated campaign in the press which exploited such fears. In the spring of 1733, petitions to Parliament and instructions to MPs flooded in from the provinces. In the Commons, when the City of London presented its petition against the excise, Walpole's majority fell to 17. And on the following day, Walpole announced a withdrawal of the excise scheme. However, the King stood by Walpole, and as a result, he was able to recover from this debacle despite the damage it caused. The general election that followed in 1734 was especially contentious. There were 136 contested elections, more than in any other general election before 1832, except for 1710 and 1722. Walpole retained a substantial majority in 1734, but he had lost the consensus that he had held earlier. The excise crisis is seen by historians as the moment which marked the beginning of an organised opposition that looked to some element of the public for support. It also marked the moment when Jacobitism, as the main vocabulary of popular opposition, began to be displaced by a purely libertarian constitutionalism. Added to this was the national dimension of the agitation against the excise. However, it's Wilkes that is perhaps the first mass movement to successfully project the ideology of popular constitutionalism into a political programme. The Wilkites built their legitimacy on support of those outside the political nation. Wilkes himself was of middle-class extraction. His father was a wealthy distiller in Clerkenwell. He was educated as a gentleman, including a spell at university abroad, and married a Buckinghamshire heiress, and through her entered the upper echelons of country society. Under the patronage of the Grenvilles of Stowe, Wilkes entered Parliament in 1757. He had tremendous wit and charm, though he was not a great public speaker, but he was ambitious, reckless and impetuous. But the Wilkite movement was far more than the character of Wilkes himself. Indeed, Wilkes told his public that he himself was not a Wilkite. He simply provided the focus for discontent amongst the middle classes of London and elsewhere, providing a cause for the amorphous group of radicals to rally around. From mid-1762, Wilkes carried on a campaign against the Earl of Bute, the Prime Minister, in his paper The North Briton. A fortnight after Bute's resignation in 1763, issue number 45 of the North Briton contained a trenchant attack on Bute and the peace treaties. The government swiftly acted, passing a general warrant to arrest Wilkes and search his property. These general warrants were of doubtful legality. In order to try Wilkes as he was an MP, he had to be expelled from the House. and the ministry, with the support of the commons, directed that he should be expelled from the house and taken to court. However, with legal proceedings against Wilkes pending, he fled to the continent. He returned in 1768 and began his campaign to be re-elected to Parliament. Once elected MP for Middlesex, he surrendered to the authorities and was sentenced to 22 months in prison for his authorship of the article in the North Briton. Support for Wilkes spread beyond London, and there were 55,000 signatures on petitions in support of his cause. The Wilkites were strongly committed to reform. They fought for the liberty of the press and argued for more frequent elections. They wanted the removal of placemen from the Commons and a more fair and equal representation. They moved from particular grievances to demands for a structural reform programme. Although historians debate the precise nature of the radicals' demands, the legitimacy of their grievances, and the extent of their support. Wilkites used cases for their own political ends. In conclusion, were the 18th century reform and agitation movements really radical? The reformers' ideal was a broad-propertied oligarchy in which the lower orders should accept their place. They sought to make the commons more representative, but had no wish to curb the powers of the monarchy or reform the House of Lords. They didn't envisage any great redistribution of wealth. They emphasised lower taxes and cheaper government, but not poor relief or reform of economic injustices. Private property rights were still sacrosanct. However, people had now become involved in the political debate and had to be addressed by politicians. In the general election of 1784, for example, Kelly discovered that radicals took an active role in shaping public opinion and in imposing electoral pledges on candidates. But the political nation did not yet include wage earners and labourers. Most of the radical groups were dominated by the middle classes. And in some ways, the radical movements were innately conservative, concerned with the restoration, as they saw it, of a mythical balance of power that had existed after 1688.